our committee members are obviously here. So I would, Dolly Sandoval would like to start today's Policy Advisory Committee of April 11th to order a little late. Sorry, I apologize for that, especially on such a full agenda day. But without much more discussion on my end, I would entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
Motion.
So moved. And it's been seconded. all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Noes? Abstentions. All right, those minutes pass unanimously. Thank you. Our next item is the Equity and Access Subcommittee. Naomi?
Thank you. The Equity and Access Committee met this morning, and we discussed the mobility management research project that the MTC has asked a graduate student to undertake, which will generate basically a white paper, which will hopefully provide some guidance in the future. Some of the questions that this project should hopefully address are, what should MTC's role in mobility management be, some examples of best practices, and what can be replicated, lessons from local projects, opportunities for future funding and parameters for that funding, and also perhaps a better concept or definition of mobility management, especially for policy or elected officials. It was noted that there's not really a good elevator pitch for mobility management. So we were happy to hear about that and provided some input on, even though it's already a pretty ambitious project, on things that we hoped would be included. We also brought up in new business some ideas about an emergency preparedness agenda item that we could discuss, and just a couple other future items that are coming up. And then several of us stayed in for the Equity Working Group meeting. And that meeting, the topics are going to be very, very familiar because we got a One Bay Area grant update. And for Plan Bay Area, we discussed the draft investment strategy and the draft for did we talk about that, 6B? We did not. Okay, so just the draft investment strategy, which was plenty. So we are going to be discussing that in this meeting today as well. But I have been asked to note that there was a recommendation raised, and a number of members who were present did give a thumbs up to that, which was that the MTC should adopt some new guidelines to the CMAs that in the next round of OBAG funding, 2015 to 16, that it be distributed to reward local affordable housing production at the city or jurisdictional level, and require cities to have adopted affordable housing and or anti-displacement policies. So at this time, I'd like to invite any of the other members who were there, if they would like to clarify that any more than I have.
Okay, no, that sums it up, and it was a really strong recommendation from the entire panel.
Okay.
That it gives the jurisdictions several years advance notice, which, knowing my jurisdiction, they're going to need.
Okay, thank you. And if anybody would like to add anything else from those meetings?
Richard, did you want to add anything or no?
No.
Okay.
Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So I guess I have a question of clarification. Do cities already have a policy statement on affordability and creating affordable housing?
Some do.
Only some. Okay. And is that part of the housing element plans or?
Sometimes.
Okay. Totally clear on that. Somewhat. All right. That's it then for the subcommittee. Yes, Richard, and then Lori.
Almost as an offer of proof, if you look at least from my county, the who have done better in the housing, those are the ones that actually have the infill requirements of below market rate housing within development.
So you can actually almost get a picture by looking at the numbers.
And then to piggyback off of that, I think state law requires that most cities and jurisdictions have an inclusionary housing ordinance. in the effort to before they even adopt their housing element of the general plan?
The attempt is to help standardize regional languaging also.
That's probably more beneficial. Okay, then let us now go to item five, the draft transportation investment program or strategy. And Anne, that will be kicked off by you, I presume?
Yeah, I'd be happy to kick this off. The bulk of the presentation, though, will be done by Alex and Ashley, but I'd just like to give a little context for this just as a reminder of where we are in this process. We had last month, ABAG came to its committee and the planning committee to talk about a preferred land use scenario, which they call the housing and jobs connection scenario. The second part of an adopted preferred scenario for Plan Bay Area, though, does also need to include an investment strategy for transportation. And this month, this Friday, staff will be presenting to the planning and administrative committees the recommended investment strategy. There will be no action on this Friday. It's really to introduce them to what is in play in terms of all the input we've gotten and to date, and we fully expect more input prior to a May 17th joint board meeting of MTC and ABAG Executive Board. It's a different date. It's in the evening. I believe it's a Thursday evening. It's to align with the ABAG's Executive Board meeting. The commission will join them at that time to review and to adopt a preferred scenario. So that's the time frame. So we have a bit of time here. Great to have your input today because we'll be even ahead of the Planning Committee's discussions on Friday. We also have later on the agenda the One Bay Area grant proposal. That's also going to coincide with the May commission action. So they're all starting to come together. Following adoption of a preferred scenario, we enter into an environmental impact report development, which will look at the preferred scenario but also some alternatives. And just so you're aware of that, alternatives to the preferred scenario will be discussed by the commission in the month of June. So there are a couple of other things that happen. And then at that point, we go into the EIR process, far less dialogue on these issues with the commission until a little bit later in the year. We expect to have a draft plan towards December, January of this coming, end of 2012, beginning of 2013. So that's where we are in the process. So today we're going to focus on transportation investment. I'll ask Ashley to kick it off, and then Alex will come in with some specifics on the finances.
And Ashley, just before you do, I want to make sure I understand this. The Planning Committee will see this document on Friday, take no action. The full commission and meeting with the ABAG directors will see this May 17th?
May 17th.
Okay.
So...
For this committee, I think as we discuss this today, we really should be looking at policy implications. And there were some policies raised, and we should figure out, do we agree with those, and to what degree do we agree with those or not? And then also, it may behoove us to bring this back to our committee on May 9th, I think, if we want to have further discussion, so that we can have that discussion before it goes to the full commission meeting a week later. All right? Great. So as we listen to both Ashley and Alex, again, let's think about what are the policy implications and how do we see that working. Frank, is this a question for clarification?
No, it's point of order. We appear to have skipped item three altogether.
Item three would be the public comment. And you know what? I did not mention that, but I did not... I did not skip it. I just don't have any cards. And so normally I say I have no cards unless somebody in the public runs up to give me one. But I didn't have one, so I just skipped it consciously. Thank you. I still don't have any cards, though, just for the record. Ashley.
Thank you. I'll go straight into the presentation. What we wanted to do in terms of starting off the discussion of the proposed transportation investment strategy is to really report on what we've heard from the public to date. As many of you know, as part of the Plan Bay Area effort thus far, we've held two rounds of public outreach. That's included public workshops, focus groups with community-based organizations, telephone polls, as well as accompanying focus groups. And we've heard a lot of messages, and what this slide does is distills the top five messages that we've heard through those two rounds of public outreach. The first is that improving the local Bay Area economy is one of the most important part of this plan. And we've heard this time and time again as part of this plan as well as past plans, that this plan really ought to advance and boost the economic prosperity of the Bay Area region, especially in light of the recession and thinking about the future in terms of where we want to be economically as a region. Second, most important part of the plan really should be about providing better access to both housing, particularly affordable housing, as well as transportation for all people who live here in the Bay Area. The second message is that there is a great deal of support for higher density housing, particularly in terms of making some trade-offs. Folks were willing to accept more homes and traffic in the neighborhood if it really meant better economic opportunities. Again, this is an emphasis on improving the local economy. And they were also interested in taking on housing density if it meant improvements to the transit services in our region. There was also a willingness to make a trade-off in terms of housing density if it helped to protect open space and resource lands in our region. The third message here is that there was high support for transit expansion as well as maintenance of our state highways and local streets and roads. There were specific comments about supporting extensions of commuter rail, particularly BART and Caltrain, putting a lot more emphasis on maintenance, again, state highways and local roads. And then we hear this from time to time as part of our long-range planning effort, which is the region still, while we have a really robust and high-quality transit service, we really need to start making improvements to that service so that it really addresses some equity issues, particularly for low-income and other transit-dependent populations. The fourth message is that land use and transportation investments really should be aimed at reducing driving as well as greenhouse gas emissions. This is certainly a mandate from Senate Bill 375, and this plan, at minimum, must meet that mandate. But we heard that these are kinds of strategies that folks would expect to see out of this plan. And they were very open to placing housing, particularly affordable housing, again, in places that are city centers and near transit, which is something that is reflected in the jobs housing connection scenario presented by ABAG. And the fifth and last message here is that the Bay Area transit system, again, while good, still has a lot of room for improvement, particularly from the customer service side of things in terms of having more frequent service, more affordable service, and cleaner and cleaner and safer services overall, particularly when you think about bus service as well as other rail and intermodal connections. What we wanted to do is, based on what we've heard, we want to show you as part of the investment strategy that both Alex and I will walk you through as to really how this investment strategy responds to some of those messages that we've heard. Clearly, the first one is that the three E's of sustainability, economy, environment, and equity, are really the policy framework for this plan. It was the policy framework for past RTPs, and we think it's still a good framework moving forward because we really want to advance through the investments that we make, improvements to the economy, the environment, and equity. The second is that the One Bay Area grant proposal, which you'll hear a little bit more detail on later as part of your agenda, is really going to be a major investment framework for this proposed investment strategy. We want to continue to support local jurisdictions who take on housing, particularly affordable housing growth, with some transportation dollars that are made available through this plan. The third is the longstanding fix-it-first policy that has been advanced by our commission in a number of past regional transportation plans still remains this plan's priority. And you'll see as we go through the investment strategy that about 90% of the revenues that are available through this plan will continue to be directed towards operating and maintaining our local streets and roads and our transit systems. And the fourth is that we will be advancing a number of high-quality, highly effective transit expansion projects as part of this plan. As many of you know, there were about 1,000 projects that were submitted by the counties for consideration in this plan. All those projects went through a pretty rigorous project performance assessment, and through that project performance assessment, we have identified a set of really high-performing road and transit projects, and what we're looking to do is advance those transit projects through this plan. And we will continue to deliver on the Resolution 3434 commitments that the Commission made way back in the 2001 Regional Transportation Plan. And the fifth is that this proposed investment strategy will carry on many of the recommendations coming out of the Transit Sustainability Project, particularly with regards to specific low-cost improvement strategies that really can improve speed and reliability on some of our major bus and rail corridors. This slide gives you a snapshot as to where we are to date with meeting our 15% greenhouse gas emission reduction target by year 2035. Just to give you a starting point, when we adopted the last plan with the projections 2007 forecast, we were showing a plus 2% increase in greenhouse gas emissions. But we've made some progress to date through some of the scenario analysis work that we've done. And where we are today is we're at about a 9% reduction with the draft preferred jobs housing connection scenario. We still have a ways to go. We have about a 6% gap in terms of meeting that 15% target. But I want to mention that the proposed investment strategy that we're presenting are in some ways, while they have a marginal effect on GHG overall, they are somehow embedded into that 9% that you're seeing on the blue arrow. The first is that the operation and maintenance elements, which is, again, about 90% of the investment plan, really underpins the land use strategy in that when we're operating our buses, our train systems, and maintaining our local streets and roads, particularly in urbanized areas, we are indeed supporting a much more focused growth pattern. And then while we make some improvements on the capacity increasing side with our expansion projects, some of the benefits that we get from transit expansions, which we know has pretty good GHG reductions, some of it's offset by some of the roadway expansions that we're doing. And it's kind of a balancing act that we do as part of this plan. And so while we make some progress in some areas, it kind of washes out with other investment strategies that are still much needed in our region. The next series of slides just kind of tells a story about kind of the steep hill that the Bay Area has to climb in terms of meeting our GHG reduction. The good news here is that for our region, we do expect to have relatively slow population growth over the next 25 years, and we already do have a fairly efficient travel patterns. So making the 15% target is much harder for our region than it is for the other regions within California. Just to give you a sense of comparison, in order for the Bay Area to achieve its 15% target, new Bay Area residents must travel about 60% less than the average Sacramento resident. And then new Bay Area residents have to travel about 75% less than the current Bay Area residents. And this next slide just kind of shows you, again, makes the point about the relatively slow growth in our region. While in our area, in the Bay Area, we see about a 24% increase in population growth, the Sacramento region is growing much faster with a 40% increase in growth. And in the next slide, just to give you a really stark comparison as to what this really means, right now in the year 2005, the 7 million people that live in the Bay Area drive about 16.4 VMT per person. In order to get the 15% reduction, what we're looking at is that in year 2035, the 8.7 million residents will have to drive about 13.9 VMT per capita. To make the comparison even starker, let's pretend that the 7 million people that live in the Bay Area now travel the exact same way in 2035. They still travel at a 16.4 VMT. That means the 1.7 million new residents would need to decrease their VMT to about 3.9 VMT per person. This basically means that a family of four would be driving about 5,000 miles within any 1 year. And to Carlos, for your question from the Equity Working Group, the 13.9, you actually just multiply that by four. And so a family of four in 2035 would need to drive about, I think it's 17,000 miles per year. But just, again, in contrast, Sacramento, they have a much different picture. So in Sacramento, the existing Sacramento residents in the year 2005 drive at about 19.2 vehicle miles per person. In order for them to get 15% reduction, the residents in total would have to drive 16.3 VMT per person. That means if the 2.2 million people in Sacramento travel the exact same way in year 2035, they would stick at 19.2, but that means that 800,000, can't see that well, would need to drive about 9.3 vehicle miles traveled per person. That's quite different from our 4 VMT per capita versus their 9.3. So again, I think the Bay Area has a lot of work cut out for itself, and that's the reason why we may not be making the same kinds of progress that the other regions have been, because our base is just totally different. What I want to do now is to transition into the investment strategy with this slide, which talks about the 28-year revenues that MTC forecasts to be available to the region over the next 28 years. The $277 billion is what we think will be available. This will be the funding envelope, if you will, for this plan. This is different from the previous draft forecast that you saw back in February. We did make some modifications to reflect some revenues coming from the Santa Clara Express lanes as well as the cordon pricing programs in San Francisco. So in looking at this $277 billion in revenue, about $186 billion has been committed. And again, just to give you a quick reminder of what it means to be committed, basically these are funds that are reserved for a specific use by law, and the commission does not have discretion to redirect those funds for other purposes. So $186 billion is basically spoken for. This leaves about $90 billion in discretionary revenues. But even when you slice that a little bit further, about $35 billion of that $90 billion is really discretionary revenues that are conditioned, and we've allocated to return it back to transit operating and maintenance, as well as some bicycle and pedestrian and other regional programs. So this really leaves us about $56 billion in revenues available for the trade-off discussions. So this is the slice of the pie that the investment strategy will focus on. This slide gives you a little bit more detail about the different fund sources that make up the $56 billion. And here, as you can see, I can't see that well. Let me just flip to my PowerPoint. About 72% is what we're considering flexible monies. And this is more some of the federal monies that have a little bit more flexibility in terms of what uses are eligible for those funds. We did include, as part of this pie chart, county transportation sales tax reauthorizations, which makes about 22% of the $56 billion. And this is really, while it's not really discretion by our commission, it is something that is accounted for because the counties, through the various sales tax authorities, have discretion about where those reauthorization funds go. And there's a small piece, about 6%, for other regional funds. And then in terms of our overall approach and thinking about what this investment strategy should emphasize and what kind of investments we want to bring forth to the commission for consideration, we focused on six different strategies. And all these strategies really aim, again, to reinforce the three E's, the equity, the environment, equity, and economy. And as you can see from this chart, about four of the six hit across all three E's. Again, we really wanted to make sure that the investments that we do put on the table really advance the three E's. And only two of the six hit only two E's, but that's pretty darn good by any measure. So what we want to do as part of the upcoming slides is to really walk through each of these investment strategies and describe what they are in our proposed investment levels. The first one is the closing the greenhouse gas gap. Again, we have about a 6% gap, and what we're proposing in this slide and the next two slides is various investment options that the commission might want to consider to close that gap. So overall, we're calling this program our climate policy initiatives, and the proposed approach here is to really advance some really innovative policy initiatives that help us to achieve and possibly exceed our greenhouse gas emission reduction target of 15%. We view this program as hitting a number of performance targets that the commission adopted. It's going to help us certainly advance on the GHG emission reductions. It's going to help us reduce vehicle miles traveled per person. And it's also going to help to increase non-auto mode share. We are proposing a $700 million investment towards the climate policy initiatives. And on this next slide, we provide two investment options for consideration. In option A, the climate policy initiatives will have an emphasis on clean vehicles and smart driving. Many of these initiatives we talked about at one of your previous meetings, but I do want to just highlight maybe the two new ones that you may not have seen before that we're putting on the table for consideration now. The first one is the Vehicle Buyback and Consumer Incentives Purchase Program. This is a $180 million investment that gets us about 1% reduction. And what this involves is it relies on the concept of a vehicle buyback program where it's designed to allow an individual to trade in their older vehicle for an incentive to purchase a cleaner vehicle. And our definition of cleaner vehicle in this instance, in terms of assumptions, is that the purchase would be the incentives would be going towards the purchase of a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle or a full battery electric vehicle. We view this program as potentially having a positive effect and would be certainly above and beyond what the Air Resources Board is assuming as part of their clean vehicles approach to AB 32. And the second initiative that is new here is the clean vehicles rebate. And what this program does is it offers a rebate for the purchase of, again, of a clean vehicle that emits less than the standard so that you can purchase another vehicle that does better. Basically, what you're doing is you're offering a rebate for purchase of a clean vehicle, but you're also imposing a fee at the same time for vehicles that are less performing or higher emitters. We think that the revenues that are collected through this rebate fee-bait program is going to be pretty revenue neutral. The funds that are identified here are really towards the administration of the program itself. And we're looking at possibly a 1% reduction here. And on the next slide, we did put on the table, as part of investment option B, which emphasizes fuel efficiency, we did put on the table both smart driving, which, again, we talked about at your previous meeting, but we also included a very popular initiative that focuses on reducing the speed limit to 55 miles per hour. And for those of you who are in the know, there is a direct correlation between vehicle speeds and vehicle emissions. The ideal speed, if you look at a speed curve, and the emissions level is about 45 miles per hour. And what we're looking to do here is to really, if you impose a 55 mile per hour speed limit, those vehicles that are now driving about 60 plus vehicles and the VMT that's associated with that would be basically reverted to 55 miles per hour, where you get much lower emissions. And you might notice quite starkingly that this one initiative gets us about 6% out of the gate. And so we thought it was worth consideration and certainly debate. But for this option B, this potentially could be a $500 million program that gets us about an 8% reduction if we were to implement both of those initiatives. There's certainly other policy initiatives that could certainly be on the list, and we certainly would welcome any feedback from you on that. I think the next slide I'm going to turn over to Alex to cover.
Great. Thank you, Ashley, and good afternoon, everyone. Investment strategy number two is really focused on fix it first. As Ashley mentioned at the outset, this plan really is predominantly about fix it first. But what we're walking through here is just sort of that one slice of the pie, the $56 billion for trade-offs. And the proposed approach with respect to fix it first is really to continue an approach that we had with our last plan with respect to streets and roads as well as transit capital. And that is to make sure on streets and roads that we're maintaining our existing pavement conditions, and for transit capital to fully fund all the vehicle replacements as well as 70% of our other high-scoring or priority transit investments, such as track work and fixed guideway rehabilitation. We're also proposing to fully fund the operation needs for existing service levels for transit operating. We're proposing to invest in our state bridge rehab and retrofit. Even with these significant investments, we still fall short of the planned Bay Area targets that had been established. And just to note that the related performance targets within the Fix It First was really to maintain the transportation system, and for streets and roads was to bring the pavement condition up to a score 75, and then for transit rehab to replace all assets by the end of the useful life, and also to reduce distressed state highway lane miles. So in this proposal before you, again, we're proposing a significant investment of the trade-off dollars of $24 billion, which if you can see the little pie chart at the bottom. As we walk through this, that pie chart will get continue to be filled by the different investment strategies. So as you can see here, 43% of the dollars that we have in the trade-offs would go towards fix it first in this scenario. Just to provide a little bit more context, you have a bar charts on the left, which really shows you the total needs in each of the categories of fix it first. And you also see what the needs and actual investments were for Transportation 2035. So just walking through one example for local streets and roads, as you can see, the needs that we had identified in Transportation 2035 were $35 billion. The needs have grown in this plan to $44 billion. And we are proposing to, as I mentioned, to make sure that we are maintaining the pavement condition at its current condition. And that's really reflected by not only the committed revenues that are shown in sort of light blue, but the yellow revenues, which are the subject of this these investment strategies. And so the yellow part of the bar chart is sort of blown up to the right. And so what you can see over there is that for local streets and roads, when we were doing these same investment trade-offs in the last plan, we proposed to put $7 billion towards being able to maintain the pavement condition, and now we are proposing to put approximately $10 billion to basically get to that same functional equivalent of maintaining our pavement condition. And so that sort of is repeated for all the different categories. As you can see, transit operations is a significant need in the region at over $100 billion over the plan, and we are proposing through committed and investment strategy these investment trade-off dollars to fully fund that at existing service levels. And then transit capital rehab, maybe I'll just talk from the chart on the right, the yellow. We are proposing again to increase the investment in Plan Bay Area from the $6 billion before to $8 billion. And we are proposing to put a new amount of money to support our state highway and bridges in this plan. So that gives you quite a bit of detail on the Fix It First side. We also included, just for information, a look at some of the other metropolitan regions in the state. And what you see, and this is actually now jumping to sort of when you put all the revenues together, so the committed plus the discretionary trade-off revenues that we're talking about today, that the MTC plan would be proposing to put 88% of our dollars into Fix It First. If you look at the other metropolitan regions, you see they all put a significant amount of money towards Fix It First, but it hovers more around 40 to 50% of their plans being devoted to Fix It First. And obviously, we have a substantially larger amount. Moving to investment strategy number three, as Ashley mentioned at the outset, we really want to continue to support the One Bay Area grant framework that we've started. And as a reminder, again, this framework is really about rewarding jurisdictions that are basically building housing near transit, and also tries to make sure that we're creating healthy communities in those areas. It does target the investments in the priority development areas. It also includes some associated support of the priority conservation areas, as well as planning, continued planning around the transit-oriented development. In terms of the performance targets, this obviously helps to reduce VMT. It obviously helps in terms of some of our health targets about increasing the average time spent walking or biking. It helps with preserving open space, reducing per capita GHG, obviously housing, the region's projected growth, and increasing the non-auto mode share. The proposal here is to put $14 billion towards this investment. Now, if you look down at the pie chart, you might see that there's a little bit of an overlap created by the One Bay Area grant and the Fix It First, and that is because of the fact that, as you'll recall, the One Bay Area grant does include funding for streets and roads. So we're just sort of showing how that there's a relationship between these two parts of the investment strategy. And just to put a finer point on that, this sort of gives that picture, I guess. In Transportation 2035, we basically had different silos of investment. So we were putting a certain amount towards local streets and roads, a certain amount towards transportation for livable communities, a certain amount for regional bikes and pedestrian. And now we're proposing to have that flow through this One Bay Area grant framework. As you can see, we are proposing a significantly higher dollar amount over the life of the plan for this more flexible approach that would allow the communities to decide sort of which needs are most important to support the health of the priority development areas. So also just to add again for this investment strategy number three, obviously a big part of the plan is about focusing growth around transit. Most of the growth that is being projected in the sustainable community strategy is in priority development areas with 75% of the growth for housing in that area and 64% of the jobs. So, again, the One Barrie grant is really meant to make sure that we are maintaining and supporting these areas, which are going to be taking a lot of the growth and also are located conveniently around our transit, our existing transit system. So moving on to investment strategy number four, I think that you you and the commission and others have heard a lot about the performance evaluation that was done for Plan Bay Area. And I think that we really want to acknowledge and really reflect the importance of putting money towards projects that perform well in terms of hitting the various performance targets that were set forth for the plan as well as from a benefit-cost standpoint. So really that is the idea of this investment strategy is to basically put money towards those investments for those projects that have scored well. Also, I'll speak a little bit about setting the stage for future transit expansion priorities and also being able to invest in a strategy that helps to bring high-speed rail to the region and on the Peninsula Corridor. In terms of the performance targets that this strategy is addressing, it's really a lot related to the economy in terms of increasing gross regional product, but also reducing greenhouse gas emissions and reducing VMT per capita. So our investment proposal here is $8 billion to support the high performers and the transit investments. So I want to speak a little bit more about the transit investments because this is a little bit new. There was quite a bit of talk about the high performers through the performance evaluation. But I think many of you know that right now the region has a policy for transit expansion resolution 3434. It was adopted in 2001, has about 20 projects, totals about $18 billion in cost over the next 25 years or so. And what we're seeing is that basically half of the projects are now either open to the public or in construction, which is really good news because for a long time it was just sort of a vision and we weren't really moving forward. So what this really speaks to is the need to start looking to the future about what will be the next investments for the region. And related to that is a big part of the Resolution 3434 program is really trying to speak with one voice in Sacramento and in D.C. to attract dollars to the region. And one big part of that investment has been the New Starts program, which is the federal program that really supports new transit expansion projects. So currently the program includes two big projects, the BART extension to Berryessa as well as Central Subway. And the first one of those projects, the BART to Berryessa, actually received its full funding grant agreement not too long ago, and I believe tomorrow is having the groundbreaking. So that means that one's well on its way. Central Subway is poised to get its full funding grant agreement within the next 2 months. So it really starts to speak to what are going to be the next priorities for the region for this pot of money that we can attract to the region and how can we sort of speak with one voice. So when we look at the revenues in the plan and we take into consideration these two projects that are already sort of well into the pipeline, there's roughly $2.5 billion that could be available over the plan to support sort of the next generation of new starts and small starts projects. So what staff did is basically look at the existing Resolution 3434 projects, because as I just mentioned, they're not all into construction, and some of them do need some help with their funding plan, and also looked at the high performers from the Plan Bay Area Performance Assessment. And basically, with those projects, really evaluated them against a set of criteria, which some of it overlapped a little bit with the high with the performance evaluation and looking at the benefit cost analysis, the Plan Bay Area targets. But we also looked at readiness, local match, the TOD potential of the projects, how well they performed against the equity targets, as well as regional connectivity. And what the table shows below, and I realize it's very, very small on the screen, hopefully it's a little bit easier to read in your packet, is that we basically, five projects really rose to the top through this evaluation, two of them big starts and three small start projects. And the two big start projects was the further extension of the BART project all the way down to San Jose. And the next one was the extension of the Transbay, the extension of Caltrain downtown to the Transbay Transit Center. Also, there were three small starts that performed very well, the AC Transit Grand MacArthur BRT, the Van Ness BRT, as well as the AC Transit East Bay BRT. So what we're proposing in Plan Bay Area is to really provide a full funding plan for these five strong performing projects that would include a combination of new starts, small starts, as well as other revenues, a lot of them local, in terms of local sales tax, potentially some bridge tolls. And I think the important thing is that what we are proposing is to still retain over $650 million of federal New Starts funds that can still be discussed in the future for other projects that are just in the planning stages right now, because there were a significant number of projects in Plan Bay Area that may not have been the top performers, but they still could be very good candidates for these federal dollars, and we would like to sort of have a future discussion in detail about that. So the recommendation would be to basically advance two new Big Starts projects and to continue to support two of the small starts as well as a new small start, and then leave enough money on the table to have additional discussions about future transit expansion projects. Also, within this investment strategy, we want to support sort of an action that the Commission took in March, which was to basically approve an MOU for a funding strategy for the Caltrain electrification project, as well as positive train control, which really sort of sets the stage for allowing that to be an early corridor for high-speed rail. And moving on to the next investment strategy number five, the proposal here is consistent with, you know, past plans where we really want to support projects that are squeezing the most out of our existing system. And through this approach, we're basically looking to continue support for the Freeway Performance Initiative program, which does support ramp meters throughout the region and has been found to be a very cost-effective way to speed travel at a fairly low cost throughout the region. We also are proposing to support the Regional Express Lane Network, and I believe you had a special meeting on that recently, so you were briefed on that program. And then also to support the San Francisco Pricing Program. And so, again, the idea of these investments are really to, you know, basically enhance reliability of the system and to reduce delays in congested corridors and really try to maximize efficiency throughout the transportation network. In terms of the performance targets, again, this one hits the gross regional product, also reducing per capita GHG, reducing VMT, and increasing non auto mode share in terms of the San Francisco pricing program. And we are proposing an investment of $3 billion. And again, there's a little bit of overlap between these investments and the high performers. The FPI project was a high performing project. This just shows a little more detail on the Regional Express Lane network. The total cost of the network is $3.6 billion. The total miles are 290. And again, I think you got a pretty full briefing on this. The investment needed would not be the full $3.6 billion because a lot of that is obviously funded with the toll revenue, but there would be a regional investment of $0.6 billion proposed. So moving on to what I think is our final investment strategy. You all have been so patient. The last one, we saved the best for last, was to make the transit system sustainable. And I think you also got a briefing on this last month and took a position on it. So we walked through sort of the objectives of the transit sustainability project that we have in the region and that the commission actually heard this morning. The objective is really to improve the financial position, improve service for the customer, and really to attract new riders to the system. And the recommendations that our commission considered this morning were to really establish a performance framework and a process for monitoring achievement of those performance targets, and then also to create an investment and incentive program, which we're calling the Transit Performance Initiative, and also to make targeted other changes in the area of institutional reforms. So again, the framework that's established here really just tries to hit the various goals through this performance approach. And I won't spend too much time going through that because I think we spent quite a bit of time last month. But as part of the investment strategy, we are basically proposing a $500 million investment in the Transit Performance Initiative. The commission or the committee this morning did basically approve funding for a pilot program of $30 million. This would basically try to very much expand on that effort through the plan and really to try to make improvements that will speed corridors that have a lot of transit use so that the transit experience is better for the customer. Let's see. So the other thing we wanted to note is sort of to complete the pie. The pie represents the $56 billion in trade-off revenues. We do have about $29 billion. We have basically 29% of the investment going to support the county priorities. And the county priorities largely overlap with the investment strategies that we presented and the One Bay Area Grant framework. And we do have a little bit of information on the county proposals. They are proposing to put just over 50% towards Fix It First, and then putting about 34% towards expansion projects, half of that transit, half of it roadway, and then another 14% of investments towards bicycle, pedestrian, and other projects. So this slide basically, if you take the whole $56 billion that we just talked about and we just walked through in the investment strategies and put it together, sort of where is the money going and what are we supporting? I mean, as you can see, that just over 70% of this is really directed towards maintenance and operations. And then also, slicing the pie a little different way, 47% is directed to public transit, some of that being on the, most of that being on the O&M side, and then some expansion. And then if we step way back and we actually add the committed revenues back in, and so that we're looking at the whole pie, if you will, the $277 billion that we have in Plan Bay Area, that's shown on the pie on the right. It really shows you sort of where our investments, what we're proposing for investments. And also the pie on the left shows you how it compares with Transportation 2035. the big takeaway that we sort of led with is that you really have 88% of the investments going towards operations and maintenance, and that's shown in the blue. The dark, the solid blue is transit, and the hashed blue is roads and bridges. And then the remaining money is going to support strategic investments and expansion projects, both transit and roads and bridges. And I think in terms of next steps, I think Anne walked through these at the outset. So that sort of concludes my presentation. I think I'm supposed to turn it over to Dave, who's going to give a quick update on the compelling case process.
Dave, let me, before you begin, so we'll take questions. We'll ask questions of Ashley and Alex and discuss the policy implications here. But you may have found something on your desk this morning as you came in for the compelling cases for low-performing projects. We're not actually taking action on this today, and I want to be clear on that the bulk of our discussion on this is going to be for Ashley and Alex, and then Dave, as you go further, then maybe we can take a clarifying question if need be after.
Sure. I'm just here to provide a quick 3-minute briefing just so you're aware of what's going on at the Planning Committee on Friday. In this presentation that was distributed is for that meeting. The Joint Planning Committee will be considering compelling cases for low-performing projects this Friday. And this process is going to influence the final investment strategy, so there may be a few revisions made to the draft strategy you just saw based off of the discussion on Friday. As you may remember, we conducted a project performance assessment for Plan Bay Area and evaluated all of the uncommitted projects, and we identified low-performing projects based off of guidance we got from our commissioners at the February Planning Committee. Of 180 projects analyzed, 32 were low performers, and these projects needed to make a compelling case to be included in the final investment strategy, meaning that they need to look at those established criteria and make a case to the committee this Friday. And what this PowerPoint shows is our recommendations as staff to the committee. In response to this process, many CMAs decided to rescope or drop projects to exempt them from the process. 7 projects were downscoped to include only environmental studies. 12 projects were identified as not identified as being a priority for this particular planning effort. 3 projects were specified as now being fully funded by local sales tax dollars or toll monies, meaning they meet our committed policy, and this left only 10 projects to go through the compelling case process. MTC staff recommends including 9 of these 10 projects. They're listed in the on the slides that we have distributed. One project remains that does not meet the criteria, and this is a 101 widening project south of Gilroy. It had the lowest score in the targets assessment, and based off of the case made by VTA, MTC staff is currently recommending not to include it in the plan, and we'll be taking it to our commissioners on Friday. The vote on Friday will be on the consent calendar, but any commissioner can remove a project from the consent calendar. And if a project perhaps is not included in the plan, the CMA could choose any higher performing project to fund. So that's just a brief overview of what's going to be going on this Friday at our planning committee. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave, for that very brief overview. I just want to mention, I think, probably on behalf of the committee, for your thanks and helping the Lifeline Transportation Program meet this compelling argument. That was a very big deal with this committee, and it's good to see that it's not just on the list, but it's listed first on the list. So thank you. Not that order maybe matters, but it always does. Okay. Let us then, unless there's any other questions of Dave. Great. Thank you. Return back to our discussion here on the transportation investment strategy. There's 6 strategies. I've got Kathleen and then Yokia, Frank, Rich Hedges. And let me start with those. And Frank, if you wouldn't mind turning, and then Sandy, turning your microphone off until I call you, that would be great. Thank you. Kathleen?
Thank you very much for the presentation. One of the things I really would like to emphasize is in that first, in the climate policy initiatives. For option B, I think it could go a long way, and as was brought up in the regional equity working group, it it benefits everyone in the region, regardless of income, regardless of location. It just it delivers broad benefits for the region. And I was wondering sort of how staff was planning to kind of work through the comparisons of option A and option B in presenting and discussing it with commission.
The commission is getting the same PowerPoint that you have. So what we are doing is presenting two different investment options for them. And so certainly option B will be presented in full. And the commission has a prerogative to do a mixing and matching between alternatives option A and B. And they can add policy initiatives just like you can. So right now this is two investment straw man, if you will, that you can kind of debate and talk about. And then we would expect modifications moving forward.
And then within the policy initiatives under option A, if these were to be included in what became the preferred scenario that was subject to environmental impact, would, since these weren't part of an earlier equity analysis, would these then be, would the equity impacts of these be factored into the environmental impact report? Where would they be explored? Because some of the things that are being, for example, Vanpool, we could see it having equity benefits for some portions of the population, but in truth, like overnight shift workers or some parts of the population really will not benefit from some of these things. So there are equity ramifications.
Sure. What we're proposing here is we're assuming an upward bound of $700 million to fund a combination of these policy initiatives, and these policy initiatives would indeed become part of the plan and therefore subject to the equity analysis. So whatever gets advanced as part of the investment strategy will be subject to further analysis.
Hi, I think she probably asked my question, but I just wanted to know in policy A, which policy initiative do you propose will benefit low income, the low income population, and which I think that the language has to, I think the voice of low income, it has to be kind of like heard in there, because I think it just gets slipped under like the rebate to buy a car, you know, but low income people aren't able to do that. So what about people who are buying cars that aren't passing the smog and stuff like that? Like the DMV has the buyback program. They'll give you $500 to buy a new car, not necessarily an electric car, but so which one is the most, which one do you guys see as the benefit for low income people?
We can certainly think through the equity aspects of each of the policy initiatives, but I would say that the car sharing, the Vanpool incentives, and the smart driving certainly benefit all residents, but certainly has a benefit to low income residents. Car sharing is an option for those who do not want to, either can't own a car or do not wish to purchase a car and need a car from time to time. So a car sharing option is certainly an incentive that could potentially advance the needs of low income. There's a lot of peer-to-peer car sharing that's happening, kind of without any government intervention, if you will, and that this is an opportunity for folks in neighborhoods to share their car if they don't need it full time. And so that's certainly an initiative that could benefit low income. The Vanpool incentives, again, this is something that could be certainly help everyone across the board, but again, if low-income residents are participating in a Vanpool, this is certainly an incentive that could work for them. And they think smart driving in general affects all drivers, whether you're low-income or not. And by just having techniques that drivers can use to make most use of their car in terms of fuel efficiency and thereby reducing emissions, I think has a benefit for all of us, but certainly low-income residents can take advantage of that as well.
Frank?
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to follow up on what was just said in reference to low-income folks. To help with the gas emission control, low-income people will have to play a very critical role. Most low-income people, if they have vehicles, are very old gasoline vehicles. They can't afford new ones. New ones and gas-efficient ones. And so it will be very important to make sure they are fully accommodated in this transportation strategy. And some of the ideas which will probably be beneficial to them is paratransit for low-income folks, gas-efficient or electric paratransit vehicles to pick them from their homes and drop them at the various transit terminals and pick them up from transit terminals to their homes. This will help all involved. This will make them leave their cars at home and depend on public transit. And at the moment, it takes some of my folks 3 hours or more to go from one destination to the other. And with paratransit available to them, they'll probably make their trips in very short time. Thank you.
So we have Rich and then Sandy, Agon, Randy, and then Lori.
I try to make this quick. I've got a couple of things to mention and one to ask. Regarding slide number 4, there's a question. What effect will the mileage requirements and all the requirements, both federal and state, have to do with our 15% goal, and has that been planned for? And then a couple of comments. I prefer, like Kathleen, strategy B. I especially prefer the idea of a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit in the urban area. I practice that almost all the time myself. I'm old enough to have been alive when we had it once before, and it actually helped congestion. There truly were fewer accidents. Deaths went down all over the country. And a corollary to that is every lane wouldn't have to be 55. In cooperation with the strategy for what we are now calling our regional express lanes, if we do it like LA does and actually block off the express lanes, either with a double yellow line or K-rail, with exits from the express lanes near freeway off-ramps, you could do it at 65. You would draw more people into the commute lane that are willing to pay, and certainly make it more attractive to people to carpool. The other issue is very simple: tire pressure. We can very easily mandate through the state of California with these other things that we're doing that manufacturers who sell in California raise, and most generally the recommendation for tire pressure is 30 pounds. I always carry mine at 35. And every time I take it in for service, unless I'm very careful and tell them not to do it, it's lowered back to 30. It's just the way it works. They're trained to do that. If you change the requirement in the handbooks, they'll do it at 35. 35 is not only safe, it's safer. You have more stability on the highway, or I wouldn't do it, just for gas mileage. The other issue I just wanted to raise is cautionary on green vehicles. I have a vehicle that's partially green. It's an E85 vehicle. I actually finally found in California a station where I could buy E85 fuel, and I did a test. The fuel is somewhat cheaper. I'm using 15% ethanol, and my mileage dropped by 22%. So there's a net loss there because of the low octane in the E85 fuel. So what we think may be a great answer may not be a great answer unless we can convert cars solely to ethanol. The other issue is the docking stations for electric cars. We've been doing the research on this where I live. We're trying to do it. We have clusters of 12 units, 6 garages under each one of the 12. One electric car plugged into any one of those garages will, because they're all on the same circuit, will blow the circuit. And our homes were built in 1980. Most of the homes on that side of the bay were built prior to 1980 and even have more restrictions. So people aren't going to just be able to plug these cars in. We're going to have to build an infrastructure for it. So what I'm telling you is if we add this to our plan, we may end up falling far short because it may not be doable in the near future, even though it's a very worthy thing to do. I'm done.
Thank you, Rich. Sandy?
I also have questions related to investment strategy number one. So on your number 12 slide, it mentions that options A and B will increase non-auto mode share. And I guess I wanted to get clarification of which of these strategies would do that. That's my first question.
I think in the previous, we could certainly strike this since it may no longer be relevant. In the previous climate initiatives policy suite, we had some biped improvements on the table for consideration. And I think when we did further analysis, we found that while there's lots of bicycle and pedestrian improvements in the plan as part of the One Bay Area grant framework, adding additional biped improvements really do not yield you the greenhouse gas emission reductions that these other policy initiatives present themselves to yield. So we did take those off the table. I mean, they were so small in terms of reductions. You're talking about 0.0 something in terms of GHG reduction that we took it off the table. And they also had really big price tags as well, so they might not be as cost effective. So this is just an artifact of the previous program.
Okay, thank you. The second question I had is for option A, was subsidizing bus and transit use an option that was looked at? I mean, if we're going to be subsidizing individual choices around cars, was that another option that was looked at?
Well,
any formula of that?
That's certainly an option that you might want to put on the table for consideration, but we have done past analyses on free transit or transit passes, and in terms of our emphasis back then was on criteria pollutants and much less on CO2 or greenhouse gas emissions. But we do find that those kinds of programs, like the Spirit Air Free Transit program that I managed a couple years ago, while it had some really good effect in terms of Bay Area response on episodic days where ozone is at high levels in the region, overall it was not a very cost-effective program, and it really didn't provide you. It did provide some benefits in terms of meeting or reducing criteria pollutants, particularly the two ozone precursors, ROG and NOx. But in general, it's fairly low and marginal. And I think if we were to think about that program and how it affects CO2, I think you'll see probably about the same level of impact, given that the free transit program, the Spare the Air free transit program, really has a much greater benefit for criteria pollutants than it does have a co-benefit for GHG reduction. So I think we did consider that, and we also had past analyses on transit passes for students, and I think we looked at that as well, and I think there's still a lot more work to do on those areas, but if you wanted to offer that as a consideration, then that's something that we could certainly look into further.
I would, and at the same funding levels that we're talking about for subsidizing cars, people switching over their cars. And then my final question was, are these described in more detail anywhere for the public to be able to look at them and get more information in order to give, you know, better recommendations of which of these we should go for?
Staff is in the process of preparing technical documentation for the calculations that we presented here, and we hope to have that available in May.
Thank you.
Egon?
Great. Thank you very much. This is a really very detailed and very helpful presentation. I mean, per the last question, obviously there's some additional detail that would like to be worked out. I want a couple of comments and questions I had. First one, there's a lot of questions about your option A in your investment strategy one, and just to sort of build on that, I mean, I think the broader question is, what's the need for public investment in some of the options you describe? Because my reaction is that a lot of these things the private sector is doing quite well in for-profit car sharing, in peer-to-peer car sharing technologies, and Zimride and Relay Ride, and all these companies are out there. So it seems like something where there's not as much of a case to be made for regional investment in it. And so I don't know if as we continue around, we might want to entertain a motion to encourage the commission to focus on option B instead of option A. To sort of, I think that that's a policy decision that very clearly could be presented to us. Not to kind of continue that more, but I think a lot of people have raised the question of why are we subsidizing purchases of automobiles but not not transit and other things. On a second category, I think what's really missing here, though, is a couple of things that this committee has talked about various times. One is an overall strategy around pricing. Now, that's not going to have the nice title like climate initiatives, and that gives you a something that's much more popular like that. And so I was trying to think of if there were to be a new category, could there be some kind of a mode shift initiative slash pricing initiative? And I'm just going to throw out a few things that could be in there. One would be something looking at full lane road pricing, right? If 55 miles an hour is not that politically popular, neither is full lane road pricing. So that shouldn't be taken out because it's politically unpopular. Also in there could be an indirect source rule, something that could be in the environmental impact report, but certainly it's within the powers of the air district to begin exploring that. A couple more that I think also could be included in that, we can slice and dice where it fits. One is what SCAG put into their RTP SES, eliminating the existing gas tax, replacing it with a vehicle miles travel tax. Certainly that requires a lot of state and congressional change, but I think the question becomes maybe MTC ought to take that one on as well as part of the legislative package. And then finally, not necessarily small or big, one would be how about looking at Prop 13 reform and a split tax roll with a transit overlay? This being something which is, in the absence of redevelopment, really a phenomenal funding opportunity to focus resources. Again, this is in the spirit of, if we're going to put things in here like 55 miles an hour, which are not politically popular, these are big ones. And then the last one in there is sort of around parking. I didn't see anything as kind of regional parking programs, encouraging elimination of parking minimums in areas. So I think there's a lot of great policy ideas in here. It seems like a lot more could be included. A couple of real quick questions that I had. One was around investment strategy number 3. The second part says focus growth around transit. And this really seems to be kind of teeing off of what you're referring to as ABAG's jobs housing scenario. In here, though, there doesn't seem to be anything that's around distinguishing between transit priority projects that would get CEQA benefits under SB 375 and just general priority development areas that ABAG has identified with local jurisdictions. So is there any program or project or policy framework you're talking about here of how to either invest in those places or support the CEQA benefits for the transit priority projects, which is a subset of all priority development areas or projects in priority development areas? Is the question clear in terms of that? And this is something where it's not focused growth around transit is sort of a mantra, but not all the priority development areas are the same. A lot of them don't have much transit, and that SB 375 allows for CEQA benefits for projects that meet a transit priority project threshold. Which is that in here? Or is that in this particular category?
I think it's in here, but in a way that may be less direct and less easily to tease out. I think some of the things that we're working on for the EIR is to be really explicit about transit priority projects and so that we can really be clear about which projects, which areas can really benefit from the CEQA streamlining. I think the way that ABAG put together the jobs housing connection scenario was to really rely on priority development areas. And in some cases, there may be a direct overlap between a transit priority project and a project development area. In other cases, we may see that the PDAs didn't have adequate coverage of a TPP area. And so that's the kind of analysis that we hope to advance as part of the EIR. It's not teased out in the work that ABAG has produced thus far. I think in broad strokes, in terms of the investment strategy that we're proposing, because we have this heavy emphasis on operations and maintenance, heavy emphasis on advancing high-performing transit projects and advancing the Resolution 34 projects as well as the next generation, I think we're making some big progress on that side of the ledger. But I think to get to your point, I think there needs to be a better matchup to the investment we're making with the TPP definition in SB 375 so we really can allow local jurisdictions that do advance TPPs to get the CEQA streamlining benefits. That's something that I'm hoping to work on through the EIR process as one of the alternatives to be evaluated. And so that work is forthcoming. I don't have a straight answer for you today.
No, that's helpful. And then one final question, which I'm really pleased to see the transit priority investment or performance initiative expanding to $500 million. That's really an incredibly important step. The question about it, though, is when are you expecting to kind of flesh out further the details of that project? I think that a lot of folks here around this table would be really interested in that. It seems like it's a major advancement in regional policy to think about that, building off of the TSP $30 million investment. But what's going to be included in that? Would BART Metro-type projects that are more on the capital side but have all these operational benefits be included, or will it be more the smaller signal priority, other kinds of issues?
Well, as you know, the pilot was really focused on sort of the bus and light rail signal type projects. So I think the answer to your question is, if the commission adopts the TSP, which they basically deferred that until May, so I guess when they do, there are some follow-up actions, including developing the incentive program. I think also developing more what the next, you know, beyond the pilot for the investment program, I think that we would probably need to sit down with the stakeholders and talk about that in terms of what that looks like and really when is the funding going to arrive. I mean, this is a 28-year plan, $500 million, but beyond the $30 million, when is the next opportunity to make a significant investment, and then what does it look like? So I guess I would say if the commission adopts the TSP, you know, in May, then I think we've got some work to do, you know, over the next 6 months on the investment and incentive program in terms of next phases and where is the money coming from.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So we've taken our hour up for this item. Obviously, we have a list still about six people, but let's be cognizant. On that list, I have Randy and then Marshall, Benna, and then Dolores.
Thank you. In the San Francisco pricing program, what's never been clear to me is if there's some type of compensation or mitigation for people who are actually going in and out of a zone for medical reasons, because while we all have great hospitals that you can pretty much get any care at, there's subspecialties that require, and I know this from personal experience, that required me to go to UCSF, because that's where the neuro-ophthalmologist specializing in the odd disease that my mother had was practicing until she moved to Stanford. So my five trips a week to the doctor would have been extremely cost prohibitive. So if somebody can, our next time we hear this, bring back some information as to how these not commute, not visiting Aunt Minnie, not going to see the Golden Gate Bridge, none of these trips, but trips that are actually required, and especially for low-income people, how that's going to work out for them, because I do have some big concerns over that with our hospitals now specializing that way. Going back, and I'm not trying to beat the horse here on page 13 and 14, but what feels very strongly to me is that by doing an option A, option B, we're almost being presented with an either or, choose this one or choose that one. And I don't like either of them in their the way they're set up. If it's truly going to be a mix and match, then just make it all one. You know, here's your options under these categories and mix and match the way you are. But what strikes me very strongly is the fact that the electric vehicle acceleration program and the clean vehicle rebate program aren't just an inequitable program. They penalize the poor who are actually subsidizing these. So I would really like some more clarity and definition on what a rebate program looks like. But I have to say that this just really strikes me as something that doesn't benefit the low-income population at all and, in fact, penalizes them.
Thank you. Marshall?
Yeah, I just wanted to add some comments as an electrical engineer who worked for a while in energy distribution. One of the costs of electric vehicles that has to be borne somehow is the cost of providing the energy to charge the batteries. At present, the electrical network is designed to furnish low power to loads that are have high peaks but a fairly short duration. The time you got your stove turned on, the clothes dryer, the elevator running up and down, those are all short duration loads. The transformer on the pole outside our house serves about 12 houses. It might run two charging stations, maybe three, but that's all. So there's an increase of roughly four in the capacity of that particular location in the network that needs to be funded if we're going to use battery-propelled vehicles. So somehow or another that has to be provided for, and I'd suggest we get the utility people involved in the discussion now rather than wait for an unpleasant surprise.
Thank you. Next is Benno.
Hi. Back on electric vehicles. So I understand that the Air District got a grant from the California Energy Commission and the Department of Energy late last year to do an extensive planning effort around electric vehicles. And I've seen plans where they're going to address some of the permitting issues. Different cities had different permitting requirements for electric vehicle charging stations. A lot of the grid issues that Marshall and Rich brought up are also being looked at under this grant. Could you guys tell us a little bit more about that and how those planning efforts will be folded into the One Bay Area or the Plan Bay Area effort?
I'll take that one. There is an EV strategic council, which you're well aware of, Ben, of being, having participated at least in observing some of those. It includes government folks, private nonprofits working in the area of electric vehicles, as well as the charger industry, the utilities, a number of folks getting together within the region to come up with what would be a strategy for implementation of a progressive electric vehicle program. So some of the issues that have been raised here today that probably fall somewhat outside of the RTP but are going to be very helpful in directing what we mean by electric vehicle acceleration over the next decade will be presented to us, I think, through that planning process. It's about a two-year period. We're going to have to wait for that to come together, but it is many sectors of the industry sitting down and grappling with all these problems. What we wanted to do here was to say we do know that a public investment, most likely, given the nature of consumer acceptance of electric vehicles, like if that is a strategy for this region, what would be the public investment that made sense? So we're just making an estimate here, and that's why all it says is vehicle acceleration. The specific pieces of that we don't really know as yet.
Dolores?
Thank you. I've heard more than once today a little bit about student ridership or student passes or something, and I'm not quite sure where that was going. But I will have to tell you my experience with student ridership was when I lived in Oakland, I would ride the bus, and there was this one school, high school, that let out and they could go off campus, and they either had free passes or they had a pass for $14 a month or something. The bus would load up at noontime with these high school students, and it would go further away than they could ever come back again during their lunch period, okay? Okay, that's one thing. The other thing was, go figure, right? The other thing was that with these passes, they were being spread around to their friends. You know, if their friends were riding, then they weren't necessarily students. So, and that takes revenue away from the transit systems. So I would recommend that this committee, if they think that transportation should be getting more money, then let's not have a prescription in there that tells them how they spend the money, because I don't think we have the knowledge in how to do that. And so I couldn't support something that this committee would recommend to the agencies that they actually would give more money to the youth program, because they're the ones that know how to work it, and we don't.
Okay, Yokia. And then Will.
I just want to comment on the 55 mile per hour. I've talked to some low-income residents, and they said that they think that they would be the target of paying the fine when they're speeding. So they're afraid that if that's imposed, then they'll have another expense. So. Right.
Oh.
Yeah, I have a few comments. You know, for low-income families, there's a double penalty. One of the things is, first of all, some of these electric vehicles, they can't plug them in because if they're renting, those homes were built pre-1960, and the landlord may not want to do the upgrades to accommodate the electric plug-ins. The other thing is, if they do, if they own a home, it's pre-1960, they would have to put out the money to do that upgrade. And then what are they saving from getting an electric vehicle? Not much, because they were going to spend a couple $1,000s at least to do that power upgrade. And the other thing is, on a lot of the low-income families, what's happening is, like for the vehicle car share, or let's say the latest one in the city of San Francisco is the bike share program. There's a high deposit, and you have to use a credit card. And looking at it, it says, how many of these have the ability to, say, use a credit card that says, we will hold X number of dollars on that account that you don't have access to until you return the bike? So a lot of these are penalizing them twice. They can't afford to get into it, even if they wanted to participate. And then it's highly, let's say, it's cost, not cost-effective to them to do it. So we have to think about, these concepts are great, but what is the current environment for the low-income families that would like to participate, but they would have to do too many upgrades? So, you know, those are comments that just hopefully that you people can take under consideration at times. Thank you.
Lori?
I won't be long. I just wanted to mention that right now in the city of Richmond, even though I'm representing Vallejo, in the city of Richmond, we have the EasyGo program that houses electric vehicles, hybrid vehicles, a kids cab, and also a van for service by all the tenants who live within that complex and outside of that complex. And I will be honest with you, there has to be some really very effective incentives to really get low-income persons out of their vehicles into these cars. Because, at low cost of $3 and you get 0.5% rebate off of that, we still aren't getting a lot of low-income individuals out of their vehicles. The program is primarily utilized by others in the community who are at moderate or higher incomes. So I think it's just the mindset of how African Americans and other people of color really think about transportation. I think more programs should be more. Some funding should be kind of utilized to get into maybe an educational piece of this so that we get into their minds a little bit more and have them think a little bit differently about transportation. Because right now people are really thinking about Cadillac, okay, or Mercedes-Benz, and not a hybrid type of vehicle and not an electric type vehicle. And I'll be very honest with you, and as I mentioned, we had this program in place since January of this year, and the ridership is so low. And then it really pretty much became like a welfare program, because we started off asking, actually taking people's children to school, and then we had to stop that because it became like they were so dependent on that. We're not a school bus system. That's not the whole purpose of this. So we actually stopped taking them to school to get the parents to take, who were very interested to take the electric vehicles if they wanted to get their children to school, rent a vehicle and take your own child to school. But then when we stopped that, they didn't want to even take that. They wanted to just get back into their cars, the vehicles that they were used to, and utilize those vehicles. So I say that to say that somewhere in this plan there should be more money that's expended towards an educational outreach, for low-income communities to change their mind and to really get them to adapt and think differently about the vehicles that they use and start thinking in a more, in a different way to use these vehicles and take more public transit.
I'm going to have Tina speak. We've got two members of the public, and then I'm going to bring it back here. Tina?
I just want to support that idea. I think that doing educational outreach to get people to change their behavior and engage people in actions to get them involved in taking and trying these new behaviors is very important.
Thank you. Actually, I only have one person on this item, Lindsay. Lindsay, you have about you have 2 minutes, and I'll flag you, and if you could wrap as soon as I flag you, that'd be great.
All right, I'll try to be quick. I've really appreciated the discussion here. So Lindsay Emai, Urban Habitat, we work with organizations across the region to support issues of equity and focus on the transportation, housing, and other sorts of needs of low-income communities and communities of color. And one of the kind of big picture items that we're very focused on is what's going to be happening to our transit system with this regional transportation plan. I think folks have identified some areas where we're making moves in the right direction, like the Transit Performance Initiative. But at the end of the day, we want to make sure that our transit service really is affordable, reliable, works for people, particularly those who depend on it. So let's make sure that we're investing in transit that's going to have the greatest impact. That's focusing on places with the greatest need and also focusing on the places where we're going to have the greatest increase in ridership kind of on a dollar per dollar basis. So we're really focused on increasing transit in our existing transit system, first and foremost. In the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen massive cuts to transit. We know, just as an example, VTA cut 8% of its bus service in the last few years, SamTrans 5%, AC Transit 15%, Tri-Delta 8.5%, County Connection 18%. And these are bus services that provide people with essentially getting them to their daily needs. So we're glad to see that the RTP right now spells out a plan to cover current operating costs, but we want to see getting back to at least pre-2009 levels. And so that's a question for staff, and it's also a request that you consider this as an important priority for the regional transportation plan. That and also ensuring that we've got enough funding for Lifeline, which is the program that has always kind of filled in the gaps with shuttles and other fixed route service. I'm getting the wrap-up sign. So those are the two issues and the two areas I'd like you to consider. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I want to bring it back up here for some discussion. And perhaps a motion. It seemed to me that a couple of items that seemed to make sense to me, and I want to see if you all agree, is certainly item number four. I'm sorry, item number five. Nah, maybe it's three. Since we have... it's not that one either. It's two. Since we have so many assets here, I do definitely believe that a fix-it-first idea is better than having to repair after it's gone beyond the ability to fix. So I'm wondering if there's a strong sense that fix-it-first as a strategy is one that we want to employ here. Okay. I think we can... Okay, move. Seconded? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Great. Noes? All right, unanimous. Yes, that was. Funding high performers, those high-performing projects, which I think is four. Item four, yeah.
So moved.
Is there a second to fund those high-performing projects? Second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions. Great. Noes? All right. What was that? TPI, the transit performance. Where was that one? Six? Yeah, oh, four, actually. Transit performance priorities. No, wait a second. Now I'm all mixed up. Five. Yes, the TPI, transit performance initiatives. Six. Why didn't we write these in order?
Dolly, on the board, we've shown the strategy.
Oh, here. Amazing. Thank you. Okay, so let us just do this. Six? Yes.
Before any motion on that, one thing that was brought up last time was really maintaining the balance as we try to incentivize, you know, these really intense ridership and service productivity increases, not losing sight of programs like Lifeline and those high-need areas.
Right, which made the list this year, so we will make that as a motion. Thanks, Kathleen. Second?
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions. All right. Which are these other easy ones we can kick out of here? I kind of got lost on which ones we've actually done. But
two,
four, and six. Okay. How about three and five? Yes, three and five.
Three is easy.
I like three.
Three. Okay. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions. That was three, sorry. Applying the One Bay Area Grant Framework, yes, Sandy.
We're going to
Our next presentation is going to be on one-way area grants, so I think we might want to hold off on that and have that discussion and then decide what we want
to do. Yeah, some of us have already seen that. That's a good idea. Some of us haven't.
Okay, our very quick presentation is going to be on that, so we will come back to this then later. And our hardest one, I think, is one. And five. Okay, so first let's deal with one. I think the sense of the committee today, Alex and Ashley, was that we don't have an A and a B option, that we put all these things, it's really only one more item on the A option, and ask the committee, the commission, to pick and choose. I think there's also a sense of, we have a sense of an equity concern, that whatever options they end up leaning towards, that there's a full equity analysis to make sure that low-income people in this entire Bay Area region are not the ones paying the price for those, or are priced out of utilizing some of those options. Anything else from the committee? I got Agon and then Richard.
Just to add to that, and I think you spoke to this a little bit, to make really clear the public case for the public investment side around electric vehicles, or I should say MTC's role in the public investment above and beyond the Air District.
Richard?
Yeah, your contention about putting A and B together, I think, is a pretty good idea. Just to give you one example, the in-vehicle...
No examples.
Well, the in-vehicle fuel economy already exists in most cars since 2000. So, I think it's a no-brainer.
Okay, and then the other thing under that category is you have strictly under the smart driving strategy as an education campaign, but I think I heard from the committee clearly that we wanted an overall educational campaign to drivers on getting out of their cars and the benefits of using transit or other types of methods to get to work besides a single car driver. So I think that was... Moved?
Seconded.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Sorry, I didn't see the light.
I didn't put the light because it turned the light on.
Okay.
Sorry, there's
also... It was moved and seconded. I'll rescind the vote. The voting, yes. And we'll take two questions, Randy and Sandy's.
Well, my question is, bicycles, which are the cleanest vehicle we have, aren't in here. So I wasn't sure where those fell, and I should have asked that question earlier. But are we voting to include all of these prior to any equity analysis? So we're creating a policy without knowing the equity benefits.
We're creating a policy to be looked at and then have the equity analysis applied thereafter, yes. So, and remember, we're not creating the policy at this point. We are putting language forward to say, how can we address climate policy initiatives under kind of a clean vehicle, smart driving practices? And so rather than just throwing that out to the commission to address, these are areas to be looked at, but an equity analysis will be applied to those points.
So the question is if we vote for this going forward, we're saying we approve them establishing a policy that includes whatever they pick from this menu prior to an analysis.
They're not picking prior to an analysis, as I understood it. Ashley, Alex, clarification?
Can you ask me the question one more time to make sure I got it clear? Sorry.
Is the commission picking, like if they look at this laundry list and they say, well, we want to consider pursuing items one, two, and three, but not all five items on this laundry list when you combine A and B. Are you then doing the inequity analysis on that as to what they'd like to look at, or are you doing the inequity analysis on all six items? Okay.
Let me try the question again. The question is, if they pick items 1, 2, and 3, are they choosing a policy to go forward with, and then an equity analysis gets done after they've chosen these three things as part of their policy for reducing, for clean vehicles or fuel efficiency?
The way we have it slated now is that the policy initiatives are part of the overall proposed transportation investment strategy, and the whole program, the whole investment strategy, will be evaluated through the equity analysis. So it's not pulling out specific initiatives. For example, we're not doing an equity analysis just on what happens to TPI. Therefore, we would not be doing an equity analysis just on EV acceleration. It's a program of projects. That's the way it's laid it now. So I think the answer to your question is no in terms of the way you phrased it, but yes, when the commission, when we present this to the commission in April, we will come back in May with actual performance results, and that performance results includes an equity analysis of the entire program of projects.
Okay. Let me see if I can't try this. I forgot who moved and seconded that. Agon seconded. What if we take this off of our discussion for voting today and bring this back to our committee? Because we said at the onset of this agenda item that we would have time in May to discuss this item if we needed further clarification. And since the commission's not meeting till after we meet in May, perhaps that might suffice, kind of trying to figure out where do we go from here right now on this item. Sandy, does that address your concern? Well, I guess first I have to make...
As the maker of the motion, the concern I have with that is that there are good parts about both A and B, and that unless we give them some direction that we want them to find the better parts of it, then do an equity analysis to see that if it works before it's selected, that they won't have any direction for us before they start getting into this.
Okay, Tina?
So I was hoping we could make some kind of recommendation that you already laid out. Maybe not that they select these certain ones, but you made a lot of good recommendations that I would want them to hear.
Okay, Sandy?
I guess I just wanted to, because I agree, I think what we need to do is give recommendations about what do we think about these general strategies, not pick this one, pick that one, but just in general our concerns. And I heard an overriding concern around equity for A and for A and B, A in particular. And so for me, it's stronger than just we have concerns. I think that we would want to have more information before we could make recommendations about specific ones. And as far as my ask about hearing more about what if we subsidize public transit, which I think directly benefits poor people, it wasn't, let's put that proposal in. It's like, I'd like to hear more information about it. If it wasn't looked at, I want to see if it's looked at, how much would it cost, and just generally, what does it seem like the benefit would be from doing that? So I think we need a little bit stronger recommendation than what we currently have.
Randy? Okay. Richard?
All I would say is that we did make a motion and we voted, so we're going to have to undo that vote. You just can't rule it out. We're going to have to vote to rescind it, or we're going to be out of order if we want to rescind it.
So moved.
Is there a second to the rescinding of the vote that was taken before all this discussion started?
I'll second that.
Okay, discussion on that motion?
Can we table this for next month when we have more information to operate on?
There's been a motion passed. If you table it, the motion will go forward. You have to vote to rescind it.
To me, the intent is to come back next month to address this issue.
The order would have been, when the motion was made, for somebody to raise the issue of tabling then before it was voted on. We need a motion to rescind, which has been made and seconded.
Right.
We just can't have one person stop a motion. Well, you can withdraw your motion.
I continued the conversation, but the vote had technically already been taken. Carlos?
Just a technicality. The only part of the vote that was taken was who was in favor.
Correct.
So we haven't finished that. I don't know what that means, but we didn't finish the vote.
Well, it was... pretty well, except for two people that spoke up. It was pretty clear that everybody, what I heard, everybody voted for, except those two people.
Well, wait a second. So my bad, stopping in the middle of a vote to take up a question that wanted to get in before the vote taken. I'll own that. But we will continue the vote. Well, does motion to rescind? I guess you have to finish voting before you can have a motion to rescind the vote.
Yep.
All right, all those in favor of saying no on the original motion. So I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So that vote passes. And all those abstaining? 1. Okay, so that vote still passes. So now there's a vote, there's a motion on the floor to rescind that vote. All those in favor of rescinding the vote that just passed?
Yes.
Okay, so if you could raise your hands, it would just make my little mind easier. Okay, so I'm not counting. Okay, so noes, abstentions. Okay, so that the rescinding passes. So that vote is now null and void. So now, is there a motion to be made on item number 1? Investment strategy 1. Yes, Anne.
May I make a suggestion?
Yes.
Because I'm hearing a couple things. One is you gave us a lot of good feedback on the individual strategies under investment strategy 1, which is to close the GHG gap. It sounds like you want a lot more information on some strategies that may not be on there yet or what have you. We can take that and get it into the discussion with staff and with the commission, saying, here's the feedback we got on what you're seeing today, commission, on Friday. And then we could have something come back to you in May that will hopefully answer some of those questions. I just want to clarify, though, what number 1 is really about, is we fail to meet our target for GHG emission reduction. We have to come up with strategies to fill the gap. There are some that are more cost-effective than others. That's not the only criterion, but that's really what drove a lot of what you see today. And not every strategy is going to do anything with respect to GHG emission reduction. So what I would just suggest is that with the feedback that we received from you today, that you give that to a staff to formalize, you know, add it to our little presentation on Friday to say this is what we've heard so far. Nothing yet analyzed. We'll take it back to the Policy Advisory Council so that when they do meet again in May, they'll have that information. I just want to just suggest that as a way to get through this.
Okay. Any other comments on this? Kathleen?
Just in regards to investment strategy number 5, I don't know if we were going to take up any further guidance on that, but that's that and investment strategy number 1 are where I believe some of Egon's good points and some of the considerations that came up in the equity working group about VMT tax and more full use of pricing potential. I'm not sure where staff thinks they should be, but that's important.
Egon?
Well, I was going to say maybe put in a motion we would like to we move that we encourage staff to specifically look into questions like pricing and VMT taxes as additional policy considerations for item 5 or item 1.
I would ask that all of it be captured in 1. And the reason for that is that after we deal with all the other transportation investments, we still have this gap.
Right.
And what you're suggesting is that there are some things we haven't looked at yet, although I think there's been some analysis, but it's not clear here how far that would get us and under what requirements. So if that would be all right with you,
That's fine.
Allows us to keep it fairly clear under 1.
Tina? Okay, so that was a recommendation for action. Is it the sense of the committee that's what you want to do, or does somebody want to make a motion to that effect? Okay, I think it's the sense of the committee then. Thank you. We look forward to seeing that back here on our agenda in May. Thank you. Thank you, Ashley, and thank you, Alex.
So we're not talking about 5?
We could talk more about 5, although we do have another lengthy item, but... Anne, was that your idea that you were going to bring information back on 1 and 5, or just 1? The GHG reduction, or the pricing discussion, et cetera, really came up under 5 and...
Right. I was just suggesting that the pricing is yet another strategy you could incorporate into the GHG emission reduction gap.
Okay, well, then I think we need to probably take up five if there's a motion one way or the other. And the committee may be Aegon.
Well, the only, I know we have very little time, is we spent a lot of time talking about the regional express lane network. It is a key component of Strategy 5. A lot of questions were raised. A lot of concerns were raised. I would say to probably sum up my main consideration in looking at this, and this is why I just mentioned pricing under here, but this is called squeeze more efficiency out of our existing system. And one of our comments about the regional express lane network is that it's not primarily conceived of as a demand management system. It's primarily conceived of as a funding mechanism to add more HOV lanes. So I guess my comment is in part grouping it under here in these things may not be an appropriate grouping. And separate from that, we raised a lot of questions about it that we think staff heard, but I think, I don't know if it's a motion or a comment, that it doesn't fall squarely into this concept of squeezing more efficiency.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I agree with you. One of my concerns is I'm not sure what squeezing means. If it's squeezing it out of the highways, I'm all for it. If it's squeezing it out of transit, what it's meant where I live is cutting lines east-west. So I want to make sure what we're talking about when we're talking about squeezing. And there's already, through the SCS policy, squeezing on benefits and wages. So
is it the feeling of this committee to not to be silent then on item 5, having not heard any
I just need to
language.
Know a little bit more about what we mean about item 5.
That's pretty sensitive. Okay, so Alex.
Well, I just want to respond to Rich that it really doesn't, the specific strategies or the specific projects and programs under item 5 don't include transit. It was the Freeway Performance Initiative, the Regional Express Lanes, and the, I might have said that wrong because it does have the San Francisco Pricing Program, which might produce revenue that can support transit.
Well, supporting's fine.
Yeah, it doesn't squeeze transit.
And just one other comment, it wasn't raised, that the Freeway Performance Initiative is bigger here than I think in T2035, and so maybe part of the overall comment is we want to understand a little more what's a component of that, because some of that actually has money that can be, I think, go off to transit as well if it's on arterials. There's co-benefits of some of those investments. So it maybe understanding what a little more what is meant by these, because it's a considerable package, and then also the comment that the express lane network is not necessarily a demand management system.
So it sounds like 1 and 5 will come back to us in May. Okay, great, thank you. I know we're busy and we're a little behind, but we're going to go on to item number 6. And Alex, that's you, the One Bay Area grant. It may behoove you, Alex, since we've seen some of this, is to highlight where you think we really should be looking at what's changed, and then we can maybe open it up for discussion or comments.
Okay, thank you. Well, as you noted, you saw this in January. You gave feedback to me, and I think that your specific concerns had to do with transparency, with the affordable housing policies. There were some very specific things that you had concerns about. So I guess I'll try to spend time on those so that you can provide comments, additional input on those in terms of what changes we've made to address those areas of comment. Just so you know, we added a fourth year to the program, so the overall dollar amount is larger, and that really had to do with being able to deliver our federal program more effectively. You did have some concerns about the priority development areas, some flexibility that had been in the original language, and that was we had an allowance for projects that directly connect or provide proximate access, that was allowed to count towards meeting the PDA target, and you had some questions about that and exactly what does that mean. And so our additional revisions and clarification on this is that we do think it's best for the congestion management management agencies to make the determination rather than having us provide specific definitions. But that said, we also are expecting and would we require that the CMAs really have a transparent process for doing that, that would basically map and sort of justify the projects that are clearly outside of the PDA boundaries to have a policy justification for why they are recommending that they should count towards PDAs. I'm not sure if you had a lot of discussion about the priority conservation areas, but there was some interest in expanding beyond the north counties. Our recommendation really would only open it up to other counties if we're able to leverage additional funding beyond the $5 million. So that's our proposal there, and that we also would come back with additional detail on this program to the commission before we would put it out for competitive call for projects. So there would be another opportunity for comment. And so I think a lot of the comments that we received, and I know a letter that we had as a handout for you today on this item, really centered around the affordable housing policies that were in the One Bay Area grant. And I think there are really two specific issues that were raised. One, the fund distribution for One Bay Area grant is at the county level. And so there was some there have been requests to basically have the fund distribution down to the jurisdictional level to ensure that there is sort of this tight sort of reward for those jurisdictions that are producing more housing. The second area of comment and concern that has been raised is really just that the performance and accountability should include the requirement that jurisdictions put in place specific policies to address affordable housing production and community stabilization or anti-displacement. So in terms of the proposal that's before you today, I think on the fund distribution question, we really think fundamentally that the CMAs need to be sort of the lead on establishing priorities in the county. However, we do feel that it's important for them to consider affordable housing production and, you know, within sort of the other issues they have to consider in the project selection. And to that end, I know in your packet we do have a lot of data, and we did publish exactly by jurisdiction how much of the formula it comes from the low-income component, it comes from the housing production component, comes from the RENA and so forth low-income component. So we really wanted to make sure that the information's out there and that at the county level there can be a discussion about which jurisdictions are really contributing the most and doing the most to provide affordable housing. Another really, really important part of our of the new proposal in front of you is a lot more information about the PDA growth strategy. And I think there were a lot of questions about, you know, what is the PDA growth strategy? And really, the PDA growth strategy is something that the CMAs need to prepare to make sure that their investments are really supporting the growth, their transportation investments in the PDAs. But in particular, there's quite a bit of detail, and it's an attachment to the memo, which would also provide an opportunity for them to work with local jurisdictions and through a process that does engage other stakeholders to really identify what housing policies exist right now for the various jurisdiction, because there needs to be a better inventory of what policies are in place right now, as well as what are the pressures that different priority development areas face. So the PDA growth strategy really lays out a framework for that, where additional information would be gathered and with support from the regional agencies, and that they really identify what policies are sort of missing to either help produce more affordable housing or to make sure that current residents aren't displaced in priority development areas. And another feature of the proposal is that we would link, the MTC may link the release of future funds starting in FY16 to progress of the local agencies in actually enacting the policies that are established through the PDA growth strategy. So, again, we've tried to set forth a really a good process that acknowledges that there's a lot of information that still is needed in terms of what policies are in place and what policies will be best to make sure that we achieve the outcomes that we want, which is, you know, a better balance of affordable housing as well as making sure that residents aren't displaced. So that's sort of what you have before you. We also, through the PDA planning grant program, do want to place an emphasis on meeting the affordable housing objectives. So that would also be another feature. I think that you probably want to spend some time talking about that. I guess I would just say there were also comments on other areas of performance and accountability with respect to the housing element adoption and complete streets. We have made some changes that we thought would better allow jurisdictions to meet these requirements. So instead of requiring a general plan update for complete streets, we were going to require an ordinance. We actually moved the date forward to October 1st. We're hearing a lot that that's still not quite feasible, that people are going to need more time. We've already heard that. We also are recommending a waiver process for the housing element. We hear sometimes that HCD is not approving housing elements, and sometimes there's a good reason and sometimes there's not a good reason, and it's unpredictable. So this would allow for at least an appeal of a jurisdiction to come to the joint planning, MTC planning, and ABAG committee to make their case for why they should receive a waiver from the housing element requirement. These are just the deadlines. Again, we've already gotten some comments that some of these still seem a little aggressive. I think also along the framework of transparency that we heard from this group in January, we do establish a reporting process at the MTC that would occur in late 2013 after the counties have selected projects, where we'd really look at what is the mix of projects that were selected, you know, how did that fit within the PDA framework, how did it support jurisdictions that were providing more affordable housing, how were the complete streets elements met, how was the public participation process. So we'd actually kind of do a debrief on all of that so that we could inform the future cycle. There was also a request for more funding for safe routes to school and also to continue to support the pavement technical assistance program. We're proposing to continue the safe routes to school at the $5 million county level that we had in the first cycle. So we do that for all 4 years. And we're proposing to slightly increase the PTAP program just to make sure we can do the surveying that we need to do for the jurisdictions to most cost effectively maintain their pavement. And the rest of this is really sort of just for information of sort of putting it all back together since we've changed the years and the numbers. So this shows that we're at about $800 million, $320 would be to the counties for One Bay Area grants. This is just a reminder of the distribution formula, which has the housing in it. And this is by county and eligible projects. And I probably should turn it back to you for comments since I know we're short on time.
Comments on this item? Wow.
I have a really small one.
I knew it would start.
Yeah, I have a really small one. I've said this before, and it was in the other one, that the OBAG and the framing of it, you talk about it as a way to incentivize or create an incentive for housing near transit. Certainly all the criteria are related to housing, but a key core idea of the SCS is also jobs near transit. And so just as part of the language of the motivation of those investments, it would be appropriate to include jobs. I recognize that's not a criteria about getting the money, but just in terms of the policy goals of investing money in the core, that's a piece of it. I had a second really small question, which is, has it come up at all, you're talking about directing the money to CMAs directly, but with cities like Corte Madera voting to leave ABAG, has it come up at all ever in discussions that cities that sort of abandon the regional process ought to, and this is a more radical idea, ought to not get access to some of these funds? And I know that the CMA framework wouldn't preclude that, but I just wanted to sort of put it out there because I think that we're sort of in a moment right now where a number of jurisdictions are really not engaging with the regional dialogue for a whole bunch of reasons. And this is now one of the very, very small tools. It's trying to create an incentive about where growth goes, but just maybe there ought to be a stronger stick as related to that.
Is that a proposal? There haven't been any discussions about that, so I'll just take that as a comment.
Okay, Kathleen?
In terms of the affordable housing production and preservation and the looking at future progress towards enacting the affordable housing policies, how do you see that lining up with the other kind of requirements of SB 375, such as like having the supportive zoning in place 3 years after the housing element? Like, is there going to be an alignment with sort of the larger statutory requirements as well as this policy requirement? Sure. I'm not sure who's monitoring that for the state or if HCD is going to work with individual jurisdictions on that, and MTC will work with them on this component.
I am not sure I have a good answer for you, so I probably will need to follow up with you at a later time on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sandy?
I know that folks are leaving, and so I wanted to get to this before we lose quorum. At our equity subcommittee, at our equity working group meeting prior to this meeting, when we discussed this, there were some serious concerns still about whether or not the proposal as it currently stands is going to really incentivize affordable housing to the extent that we would have liked. And after much discussion, the recommendation that was made was that for the next cycle, that we put language in place for the next cycle so that all jurisdictions know what's coming, that local affordable housing production at a local level would be considered and would be a criteria, as well as having policies in place to protect against displacement. And I know we also haven't heard from the public, so I'm concerned about that. I know I have to leave in a minute, so I didn't know how we want to move forward.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion. We're going to lose quorum. We may not be able to take any action on it, but we're going to continue this discussion until everybody's heard. So if you have to go, I totally get that. We are hoping that people will be able to stay next month until 4 because we have a hefty agenda.
Could I make a suggestion that we start the meeting a half hour early because some of us are going to miss transit connections? We're staying anyway.
From what I understand, we cannot start earlier, but I have Randy and then whoever else, and then the public.
I would just like to put the last statements in the form of a motion so that we can process that we support what happened at the Regional Equity Working Group. Do we have a quorum?
Yes. Can we take a vote without having public comment first? That was my only concern. I thought we had to.
We do have to have public comment first, but you can always make a motion at any point an item is opened. So you can make the motion, hear the public comment.
Okay, go ahead, Randy.
I want to make the motion that we support the same vote that was taken at the Regional Equity Working Group, that the affordable housing component and preservation, along with the displacement criteria, is part of the policy going forward for the next round of funding.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded. Rich?
I voted in favor of this myself earlier. I'm a little concerned that we've had so many people leave and then this was raised. I'd be more than willing to vote for it at the next meeting. But I don't think it's a good idea to run long and people run. They might resent not being able to vote on it.
Any other comments on the motion? Okay, so I'm going to hear from two. Was that yes or no? Okay. Maybe it was the arm going up into the sweater. I thought was an arm. Okay. I have two members of the public to speak. The first one's going to be Aiden.
Well, both of us want to cede our time so that the vote can be taken.
Okay.
A lot of our comments were in that letter that was circulated. So thank you.
Thank you for ceding your time in that instance then. All those, any other discussion on the motion? All right. All those in favor of the motion? I opposed. Abstentions? I didn't see any opposed or any abstentions, nor here. So that motion passes. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Okay. Next item on the agenda, Pam, the staff liaison report.
So obviously I'll be brief.
As Dolly mentioned, we are hoping that next month you'll be able to stay till 4 o'clock for the meeting because we will be presenting the draft plan at that point. And there are also some items from this meeting that will be coming back to you. So there's a lot to discuss. If anyone can't do that, if you could please let me know, send an email to me or to Leela so that we can make sure that we have a quorum and it's all going to be good. And then also in June, annually I schedule a work plan between you and the commission, and we are currently looking at the possibility of doing that in June. That could mean, because of other agenda items that keep coming your way, that could mean the need to have two meetings in June or the need to move your meeting to the commission day in June. So that's just a question out there for you. If we were to move this meeting to June 27th, still a Wednesday, but earlier in the day, is that possible for you? So we will be sending that your way, that request your way as well. I won't do it today. There's just not enough time, but we will send that out to you. So please respond back on that question as well. We are out in recruitment mode for the four vacancies for this council right now. In Sonoma, Marin, San Francisco, and then the at-large position for environment and economy. So that's up on our website. Take a look at that, and please send any inquiries my way. And I will leave it at that.
All right, great. Thank you for good discussion and motions on our policy efforts here, and have a great month. See you next time.